And welcome to the February 7th edition of In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm your host, Kent Osborne. If you have questions, we hopefully have the answers on Facebook. We're simply facebook.com/techradio. You may post your questions or comments there. Don't be shy. Send us a text. It's 956-SDPB. That's 956-7372. And Twitter users, you can send those questions to me at KentSDPB. And, of course, the email address that that is probably the most popular way of communicating with us, inthemoment@sdpb.org. We have gathered the experts to talk tech today in the Kirby Family Studios in Sioux Falls. Is Amos Asap. Hello, Amos.
Hey, Kent. How's it going?
Welcome back, sir. And
thank you.
Twiddling the knobs is John T. Meyer.
I know. Oh, dangerous, huh? First time.
Yeah. This is way cool. This is the reward you get for coming back.
Is the roads bad down there? You couldn't make the drive, or how is it?
Well, you know, we're in legislative day 16, and it's just occupying my day today.
Got it.
Trying to get the
little
get the job of the
here
people
in Sioux
done.
Falls, so.
Yeah. Really, it was just workload today, keeping me from joining you in Sioux Falls at the lovely Kirby Family Studio. But would love to be there, but unfortunately can't be today. From the city of Pierre, Jeff Litterick. Actually, he's not from the city of Pierre. He's in the city of Pierre. You're with the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
Good to have you back on board. Lots of fun things to talk about. Some interesting kind of cool things. And one thing that kind of popped out to me is, do you remember, and anybody on the panel here, when you first discovered Google Maps? Was it as kind of, I don't want to say life-changing, but was it kind of that killer app feel that I felt it was? And the reason I bring this up, Google Maps is 15 years old.
Now. Okay, interesting. I was going to guess, yeah, let's see, 15 years, so 2005. Sounds about right. I was going to say college for me.
I wouldn't say that Google Maps itself was life-changing, but before that was MapQuest, right? The ability to go in and type in something that would... And I don't know if you're specifically referring to the satellite imagery or anything.
I was trying
like
to remember
that.
If Google Earth became before Google Maps, but I remember the first time you had Google Earth and you would type in your address and you could find your house.
Right.
And it was crazy.
And and then before that, MapQuest to be able to get to places. And I remember folks who would use MapQuest and then print it out. And I thought that you're defeating the whole purpose. But you know, the idea of being able to not unfold that crazy map in your vehicle anymore. That nobody could ever get folded back up again. It is altering technology for sure.
Well, and it's funny how like that example effectively basically killed the Atlas industry, right? Like some people might have an Atlas. You can still go to a gas station and buy an Atlas, but yeah, the market share of Atlases.
Is there a lot of openings for cartographers anymore?
I mean, those tech companies want like people with GIS degrees and that type of skill set, but. Yeah, and I remember when the early days, the first time you would see one of those Google Maps cars on the road, you know, because at first they started in all the cities, so certainly South Dakota maps weren't indexed right away, but you would see one of those cars with the 360 camera in a big city, and that was a big deal when you saw those funky cars.
Yes.
You know, and then people started wearing the backpacks because measuring, or I don't know, mapping, I guess would be the right word, like hills, like even when there wasn't road, off-road type of things. I mean, they're organizing the whole world's information, which is Google's mission statement.
So as an Android user, I have the timeline built in where your phone keeps track of where you're at and then creates a timeline of where you've been. You go back and you can see. And my farthest back timeline only goes back to 2009. I don't know if that's how far back... Okay. Androids have been keeping track of that, but I would suspect that, you know, in their early years, it probably wasn't as well. They weren't keeping track of that sort of stuff until it became a robust application.
15 years, huh?
Yeah, that's a time, and I'm touched a little bit more than some, but you know, as far as the what I thought was kind of a revolution in how I moved about or I don't navigate well in larger cities, so this really helped. And yes, okay, I'm guilty. I did used to print out the instructions on what I was supposed to do back in the day because I didn't always have a phone on the dash or things like that. And I a lot of times had a navigator, and you know, it was just handier for that person to be able to tell me where I needed to go to get it to the right place at the right time.
Well, I think what's fascinating is 15 years in the lens of technology, right now we're like, oh wow, that's been a long time. That seems like a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But in the lens of just how it's changed our world, it's so short. I mean, if you think of how many people now have their phone where they mount their phone up front and use their, like, that was another industry. Remember when everyone had the GPSs kind of mounted on their computer?
Garmin.
Yeah. I mean, those are almost irrelevant now too, because it's already in your phone.
Yeah.
And think of the iterations that have happened in just 15 years, technology wise. It's incredible. Well,
and that, speaking of the navigation, the first time I got navigation in a vehicle, I thought, wow, this is amazing. I can go anywhere I want. I will never, ever buy a vehicle without navigation. But now it almost seems like a waste, because navigation in your vehicle doesn't get updated very often.
Just feels distracting.
And in fact, I just got a letter in the mail that I could update the navigation of my current vehicle. But they want like $350 just to get the new roads that have been built around Sioux Falls, and whereas my phone will always have the latest stuff, or, you know, relatively anyway, and so I don't know that I would purchase a vehicle with navigation in it anymore.
Google Maps. Google acquired Waze years ago, mm-hmm. and so Waze is a startup, Israeli startup that uses other people's map data to give you in the moment live updates. So if there was a car accident, or someone got pulled over by a police car or construction, or it will tell you and then suggest alternate routes. And so Google Maps has that capability now too. Okay. But that was a game changer too, that it wasn't just, this is the quickest point from A to B, but this is the quickest point today in this moment.
Right, exactly.
From A to B.
Yeah. That was and I mentioned that on the show a while back, that was a mind blower for me last summer driving into Louisville and Google Maps saying, hey, is there still a trooper at mile marker blah blah blah, and as I'm going by mile marker blah blah blah, and I'm like, oh yeah, there is. Here's your confirmation. Or no, there isn't. Or is there still a broken down vehicle at this exit? And you're like, oh wow, that was just kind of like, you know, and I don't know if we're ever going to see it to that granular, you know, on Highway 50 or whatever in near Vermilion, but maybe we will.
Well, then it just makes the more, like, it makes me laugh at the ultimate trade-off that we've decided as a society to more or less mm-hmm. make with technology. So you're like, yeah, I can track everywhere I've been since 2009. And and in many ways, that has made your life easier and convenient,
right?
And helpful. And also, you've just given all of your, like, history and your whole life, like, wherever you've been,
right,
to Google.
Yes.
And so it's this amazing just, like, value exchange that, whether we realize it or not, we've all made, more or less, most of us, mm-hmm. by accepting the terms and using this technology.
Yeah, you've horrified some of our listening audience.
Absolutely.
Going, oh my gosh.
And you can turn that off. I'm aware of that. Yeah. And it's a concern that I certainly have given thought to, and I haven't given up on completely. It's still, privacy is still an issue that comes up for me. I still reconsider these things on a, I don't say a day-to-day basis, but on an occasional basis. And at this point, it's working for me.
So so an interesting thing is that, so because people use the phones in their cars to navigate, Google has a algorithm that says, okay, these phones are, when they're moving, they're in cars. And so a German artist kind of figured this out, that Google was using this. So he went out and borrowed a bunch of cell phones from his buddies and rented some and had some of his own. And he got a little red wagon, just like a little red wagon like you'd think it was, and put 99 cell phones in the wagon and turned on
okay.
Google Maps. And then he walked around the city in Germany, causing what Google thought was a traffic jam.
Oh no!
So
that's
because,
funny,
and, because they
and he called it art. But yeah. Anyway, yeah. It's interesting that I don't know what 99 has to do with anything.
99 cell phones too.
I said, he borrowed them from friends, and he had some, and then he rented a bunch of them. I don't know. Apparently, you
Sounds
can
like
rent cell phones.
Accounts.
probably some burner accounts or whatever, but turned on the Google Maps, threw him in a wagon, and there's pictures of him dragging this wagon down the street in Germany and fooling Google into thinking that there was a traffic jam there. And that's called it art.
It reminds me of those. I think there might have, was it maybe a Garmin or maybe a Fitbit commercial? I don't remember. But you've seen people who do running, who run with their GPS phone and will make essentially art out of their runs. Messages or symbols and create run in a specific route so that they can create the image. I always think that's kind of funny. Sure.
Yeah. Seems to me they're kind of like the, what are the patterns that people put in the fields?
For like crop signals, UFOs? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the totally modern version of crop formations and things. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, anyway, Google's 15, or Google Maps is 15, and I thought that was worth bringing up on the show today.
You know, there was some concern, though, about that guy who had the wagon full of cell phones, that this was a proof of concept that people can manipulate the system. Because when he created that virtual traffic jam, anybody who was using that system to navigate would have been rerouted around that area, which, you know, who knows if it was rerouted a block away or if it was rerouted a mile away. That, you know, that's not something that we have the information on, but there were people who were concerned that
how easy it
was.
Oh
my goodness, this is, but really, that seems like it's not very easy.
I mean, that's a lot of work, right?
It's a lot of work, right? And you have to walk around for 2.5 hours pulling a wagon. It's not like it was inconspicuous. So I don't know that particular method is going to cause worldwide chaos. But people were concerned that it would.
Funny. I wonder if Klaus in the strudel shop was thinking, where are all my customers today?
They were all
rerouted around him or something. I don't know. Yeah. But, well, anyway, interestingly enough.
And just to extrapolate the technology, I would definitely suspect that we will continue to see the evolution of how maps play into our life. And so as we think about the layer in which they live on top of the world, I would expect a lot of future with, like, augmented reality. You know, even going from our phones to our watches has already happened, of course, but then from watches to eventually glasses, right? Like, we still laugh about when I had the Google Glass and it was clunky and weird and goofy and awkward, and but it's going to happen. And Apple has already said that they're going to tackle it. I think 2022 is what they've said in terms of user experience and style and functionality. Usually Apple gets that part right. And if they create something that people think is cool, then the trend will often follow. And so when we talk about augmented reality, we're talking about a virtual layer on top of the real world. And so it will get to the point where you can have some sort of map, probably through your glasses, maybe even a contact someday.
Yeah, I'm waiting for contact lenses.
And then be able to just look at a place and be like, oh, okay, that restaurant is closed on Mondays, or the store hours of this retail shop, or the Yelp review of this restaurant. And you'll get it right there.
Yeah. If Joel were here, I would ask him if he had updated his light bulbs today. So a few weeks ago, a patch came out for his light bulbs. I'm talking about Philips Hue. I believe Joel was on the Philips Hue system throughout his house. And there was a demonstrated vulnerability in light bulbs. People were flying drones next to houses and were able to hack their light bulbs, and I guess in such a way you've caused a vulnerability for your network, and so they patched that. Your light bulbs came out with a patch. I like saying it because it sounds silly, doesn't it?
It does.
My light bulbs had a patch last week.
It does.
Anyway, if you have the Hue and your hub is actually connected to the internet all the time, you're fine because it's probably updated. But I thought that was interesting. Patch comes out for light bulbs.
You know, the more things that we have that are internet enabled and are quote unquote smart devices, the larger the footprint or surface area there is for an attack, right? And so in this case, if flying a drone near a house that happens to have Hue light bulbs in it that, you know, are powered on and had the flaw enabled, pretty specific circumstances, but still, this one happens to be that way. But what happens when it becomes much more widespread and much easier to manipulate? Maybe it's your refrigerator that's Wi-Fi enabled because you need to be able to check and see if you have milk when you're at the grocery store. And then people can start, you know, could do something that could cause serious monetary issues, like shut your refrigerator off or turn the temperature way up so that things go bad. These are the things where we need to make sure that we're keeping track of those IoT items and making sure they're updating when they can be, and taking all the preventive measures we can to keep things from being manipulated.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, John.
Oh yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's a issue, we'll say, that will continue to be reckoned with. I mean, cars, refrigerators, lights. Right. It's not going to go away, but there is going to be complexity that comes with it.
I certainly don't need somebody slamming on the brakes for me or steering me into the ditch. That's for sure.
I do love the saying that says the S in IoT stands for security. Right?
Yeah. Exactly.
So you just have to keep that in mind. It's up to you.
I haven't heard that one. It's good.
Well, we are time to take a quick break. When we come back, another interesting thing in the news was we found out that there were some South Dakota businesses hacked in there, and it, with kind of a twist. And we want to talk about that and explore it and find out what it is going to take to keep you safe in your South Dakota business and your South Dakota home. We're going to do that right after this. You are in the moment on SDPB Radio. It's Tech Radio. I'm Kent Osborne, and we are talking tech with the computer guys, taking your questions and comments about the tech in your life, and we'd love to hear from you. Send your questions by emailing them to inthemoment@sdpb.org or text them to 956-SDPB. That's 956-7372. I received an email this week, and it was spoke about South Dakota chiropractor in Spearfish that had some data issues, had been hacked, and it sort of rolled into another story and some links about three South Dakota law firms that had a ransomware attack by this group called Maze, and they used it, what I thought was an interesting thing. The chiropractic hack was a little bit different. That was a whole other issue, but similar in that I believe the folks were using some pressure to keep them from publishing data that on patients and other things. And in the law case, it was ransomware. And the threat was, it had flipped from just, here, we're going to unlock your data to, if you don't pay us, we're going to publish all the information on your clients and who's, you know, who's in trouble for what kind of a thing. And I thought that was very interesting. It's hard to, and Amos, we spoke about this briefly, but it's hard to get more information on these sort of things because A, folks don't want to talk about it, and B, which I thought was kind of which struck me was sometimes a lot of this stuff doesn't get reported to the police or to authorities.
Right, and there are disclosure laws, right, but there are limitations or limits that those disclosure laws have to be met before somebody has to report any sort of breach. And in a lot of cases, we just don't meet those limits, and of course then they don't get reported. And that's because, frankly, sometimes it's embarrassing for the entity that got breached or got hacked. They just don't want people to know about it. They don't want their customers to know about it if they don't have to, if they haven't met that threshold of the reporting laws. They try to just take care of it internally. And then, as we talked about earlier this week, if we want to find out more about it, they're less than apt to talk because of those same reasons. They just don't want their name with a breach in the same sentence. People are less likely to utilize them because they know they had an issue.
Mm-hmm. So the on the Maze attack, it was suggested that they all three of these law firms used the same host or internet host or network not co-locating, but that sort of gist of things, and that's what how they were able to infect all three of those. But the Maze group impersonates government agencies. They've been known to basically try to act like known security vendors or through trusted organizations. They sort of trust their way in and then lock your data. And then the weird, you know, here's the thing we always talk about on the show. Well, if you get hit by, you know, cryptoware or ransomware or things like that, you can just wipe your computers and reinstall your backups and you move along your merry way. And the problem here is the threat is not, we're not going to unlock your data. It's we're going to take your data and we're going to put it out on the dark web or on the public internet. And I guess that's the twist to me, and that's what adds the extra sting when it comes to downtime and having to fix things and get back up and running and get back to business, is that all of a sudden we've gone to a data breach sort of a thing. And that's and horrified me particularly. And so I wanted to talk about that on the show with Amos and Jeff and even John, and how do we prevent this in the future? How do we prevent and detect it and make sure that it doesn't happen? Because we moved away from that. Well, if it does happen, we can recover because we're all doing our backups, right? We're all keeping a copy here. We're keeping a copy off site, you know. We're doing all the things that we're supposed to be doing, but if it, you know, gosh help us, it actually happens. Somebody clicks on a link or gets infected, you know. What do we do to keep all that information safe? So I kind of wanted to go through that a little bit on the show today, talk about how to prevent. The question I guess that I'm going to start out with is I started doing a little bit of research on this, and I started thinking, well, is the antivirus and the anti-malware software solution that's on my computer at home adequate? And if I'm a business, is it now a different thing? And I guess I'm going to throw that out to Jeff. I'm running Windows. And so is running Windows Defender, and with the firewall and things that are built into my Windows 10, is that enough to cover me, or do I need to go that extra step?
Well, one thing is, especially in, for the Maze and stuff, we can start at the basis. Yep. These organizations are about money, about making money and getting as much money as they can. And that's why they've upped their game, because now people do backups where they're not paying the ransom, but they're in the business of making money, just like any other company. So for the normal home user, you have no money they care about. They have no leverage over you, right? This is one of the reasons why the law firms were attacked, and why you see medical hospitals being attacked more and more in these kind of scams, because that's where the money's at. And they're willing to pay to keep those records confidential. Because in the end, a normal home user for ransomware is a drive-by attack. You're a low-profit, low-target kind of thing, and they really don't care about your data. Now, the law firms and stuff are different, right? So for the normal home user, yeah, your Windows Defender, keeping backups, that's perfectly fine. If you do have illegal data, you might not want to have it, right, of course, because that would be a leverage over you. But they're not the primary target, because for the law firms and these kind of people where they're taking the data before they encrypt it, this is kind of a long-term, what we call engagement. They're not doing this in a matter of a few minutes or even an hour. They're doing this over a matter of days so that they can grab all the data and slowly siphon it out to avoid detection before they encrypt all the stuff. And in the end, if you think about this, it's an arms race, but it's all about the money. However they can get money is how they're going to attack you. And if you have no money, you're not a primary target. So if you think about it that way, you can set your security levels at the proper level to protect yourself. Businesses that have confidential data need to have much more robust systems that are not just on the PCs, but are watching the network traffic both in and out of your hosts and servers to see if data is leaving your servers and stuff. We call it data loss protection kind of programs and stuff too. But for the average home user, just do that. The more you could be compromised by a data link, the more protections and security posture you're going to have to build into your business going forward.
So the functions you described, that watching the data coming in and going out, is that the function of a firewall, or is that a different product?
It can be, but you can scale these products from very low cost to millions and millions of dollars to implement. Based on their sophistication and stuff, and you have to have people to run it. When you get into the more advanced techniques and stuff, either you're going to have to outsource it to somebody with good knowledge of staff, or you're going to have to build staff. And that, once again, depends how big your business is, right? But to protect that kind of stuff, because this is an arms race, they're always going to be ahead slightly of any antivirus. If you have confidential data, you need to be able to watch that data and see what happens to it. And then another thing is encrypt your data to begin with. If all your data stored on all your servers and all your records are encrypted by you, it doesn't matter if they steal them. They still can't get them. It doesn't matter if they encrypt them, because you are already far enough along. You're having good backups, right? So one of the policies we now have kind of going forward is all data is encrypted. It doesn't matter at rest or in transit. All data is encrypted all the time, so that even if it does leak out, nobody can use it.
Oh, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. May I ask this question? What do you recommend for, let's say, a South Dakota business that is smaller, shorter staffed probably than let's just, I don't want to use the, I don't necessarily want to use the example of a law firm, but a smaller law firm versus a larger corporation or corporate law firm that has many, many employees, is it natural for them to migrate together and outsource the tech?
Yeah, there are many security companies that can come in and help you in different ways and degrees. For the small business, one of the reasons why they're targeting the small law firms, actually I read an article where over 100 law firms in just the last couple months have been targeted and hit, is because of that. They don't have IT infrastructure and staff watching their service all the time, and they're out hosted.
Yeah.
You can also outhost your security services, and that's what you really need to do in terms of coming up with a security plan. There's a lot of little stuff with little effort that you can do on your machines and your servers to really lock them down. And actually, encryption of data anymore is actually pretty easy to do, especially in the Windows world. You can just turn on hard drive encryption with BitLocker built into the OS and just get everything encrypted. So there's different ways of doing it, but you do need some security expertise to come up with that plan for you. And there's quite a few companies, even in South Dakota, that do that. And also, they will also check your security to make sure once you've implemented it that it's actually working, which is an important kind of sidestep to make sure it's all working after implementation.
Yeah, and the way I think of it as a small business owner, technology has created a lot of efficiencies and in many ways allowed us as a small business, 17-person business, to save a lot of money. What we're able to do with some laptops and some cloud software is pretty impressive. But some of that savings we then have to pass along and invest in IT security. And, we are a bunch of creatives and designers and marketers. That is not our specialty. And so being willing to outsource that, I think you just have to, if you're a business owner, you have to put that as a line item nowadays. Every business has technology and you have to invest in some sort of security. So we work here locally with a company called Workplace IT right downtown. They're great. They come in, they put a little bit of software, protection software on every laptop in our company, and then they can remote access and help us out. And yeah, it's not on your shoulders, whatever your business is, to become an IT expert, but you need to then pay someone who is.
And Amos had to step away, but I feel Amos would say the same thing.
Yeah, he might have thrown in a commercial there, but
I don't want to. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but just so folks know that I'm not ignoring Amos, he did have to take a quick phone call. I had an emergency come up, and we understand
he's
that.
Doing IT security probably
he's doing
right
IT
now.
IT security right now, live on the air. So
one of the things to keep in mind also about this is, especially with like once everyone gets kind of methods and B-side backups encrypts all the data, there's going to be a new arms race, something else to come up. This is a multi-billion dollar business for these hacking groups. They are not going to give it up easily. And that's also why it's important to outsource to experts that are keeping up with the latest trend stuff, because this is always going to be morphing. There's always going to be some new angle they're going to try. And you really need to have some kind of expert or be able to contact an expert to help you out to keep a trend of all of this trends going on, because they're not going to give up easy. This is billions of dollars for them. This is their livelihood that you impact once you stop making payments to them.
Okay. Well, I want to make a quick shout out to a link that Amos turned me on to, and that's a group called NIST, and they're at nist.gov, and they just published a new framework for cybersecurity and an interesting report, and I want to pass that along if you want to do some more reading on that. I'll go ahead and link that out on Facebook after the show today, but NIST, if you want to go there, nist.gov, and page through some of that security framework and see if some of that hits home a little bit for you or answers your questions on that. Jeff, I want to delve just a little bit more. Go ahead.
Just one thing I will mention for the NSIT, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technologies. Mm-hmm. It's a government agency that's been around forever. They define all the standards for the federal government. So those frameworks and stuff you talked about are what the federal government follows for their own cybersecurity. So it's a very important, and almost the entire world bases their security frameworks off those.
It's the Bible, I guess, then, of security frameworks.
Yes, it is in many ways.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you a question quick before we have to go for a break. You mentioned BitLocker, I believe, was the term you used on personal computers on Windows 10. Is that so that isn't automatically turned on when you get your computer? That's an option?
It's usually an option. I think there's a couple OEMs, kind of more niche ones, that turn it on. Business computers automatically. But usually you do have to turn it on. It's just like a check. You get to turn it on, and you can turn it off later, but you probably don't want to. And also another thing that's coming down is, and I've seen a lot more of these where your hard drives, your SSD drives in your computer encrypt all the data automatically also, which is kind of in case you physically lose the drive, all your data is encrypted on it. So encryption has become a big thing. What we call full disk encryption, which means everything on the hard drive is encrypted at all the time. It's not perfect. There are ways to steal keys and stuff, but it makes the attacker's life much more difficult. And once you know that's encrypted, even if they steal the data, they can't do much with it. But don't forget, you still need your backups. It doesn't alleviate your need of backups.
Are those backups encrypted then as well?
They should be. It depends on the backup program you use and how you're backing up. If you're using like Windows BitLocker and doing like a remote, a third-party USB drive or something like that, you plug in the backup to, you can run BitLocker on those. Like I said, many of the SSD drives automatically encrypt all the data, no matter what, for physical access on those. So there are different options you can buy if you're backing up to just the USB flash drive. Some of the flash drives will auto encrypt. And you can run BitLocker on some of those, not all of those, but it kind of depends on your backup storage mechanism.
Okay, encryption used to take a lot out of the performance on a computer. Is that the case anymore? Are there still performance issues, or is it those all been resolved?
No. Well, there's always a slight performance hit, but the trick is, will a user ever notice it? And way back in the day, noticed a lot because it took a long time to encrypt and decrypt files. Nowadays, it's almost instantaneous. You know, you're talking a fraction of a second for access and stuff. So most users are never, ever going to notice the difference.
Okay, very good. Well, Amos, you missed your back, but I think we put a nail on the head a little bit on the maze discussion. Was there anything that you wanted to bring to the discussion that maybe we didn't talk about?
Tough to tell. I had to step up for a second because I had a small fire going on. But
tough question.
We got that at one extinguished. I would bet that you guys probably hit it all on the head. You're pretty generic in that A, you want to make sure things are backed up, and then B, make sure your backups are taken. There's an air gap in there. I do know the premise of the conversation though was the fact that when they get a hold of your data, they're going to ask you for money. Otherwise, they're going to release it, and that becomes where things get a little dicier, right? And so my suggestion actually on that is that for severely important or sensitive information, that even if they do get a hold of it, make sure it's encrypted. Even if you're storing it locally, make sure it's encrypted. When you put stuff into the cloud, and you know maybe you're using Dropbox or you're using OneDrive or something like that where they tell you it's encrypted, encrypt it before it goes up. So even if they do get access to it, they still have to have that password to find anything sensitive or be able to read that data. It does make things a little more complicated. I have a longstanding saying that security and ease of use are on opposite ends of the spectrum, but if it's important to you and you don't want that data exposed, you need to go those extra miles.
It is increasingly obvious to me that a future segment of this show is going to be devoted to encryption and how encryption is your friend, we'll call it. And it'll be on a future version of their show. For right now, we do have to step away. When we come back, we will wrap the show up today with some little roundtable discussion. We're going to talk possibly Tesla stock and YouTube revenues. And Jeff, I need to pick your brain on GeForce Now, but we're going to do that after this. You are in the moment with SDPB. It's Tech Radio. I'm Ken Osborne. We're talking tech with the computer guys and wrapping things up today. We'll let you know again that in the moment at SDPB.org, if you'd like to send us a quick note, we may get to it on the show today. It may hold in the queue for, I believe, it'd be the 21st. But certainly feel free to reach out to us in the moment at SDPB.org is a great way, as well as our Facebook page, facebook.com/techradio. We do have a couple of questions. I want to get to the first one, and I don't know if I have the answer to this. Maybe somebody on the panel does. It says TracFone is soon to change to VoLTE, and I had to get a compatible phone. So they're doing a system upgrade and needed to get into phones that worked with that. I wanted to use my old Samsung S5. I changed out the SIM card, but now I am no longer able to forward calls to another number. How do I get around that? Can I put the number I want to forward to in place of the voicemail number? Thanks. And I don't know if I specifically have an answer for that. Anybody want to take a crack at that?
Well, I'll start, and I don't know that I've got the right answer for it either. But so VoLTE is voice over LTE, like VoIP, you know, VoIP.
Oh.
So that's what VoLTE is. And that's basically making an older phone that has data capabilities, but older actual telephone capabilities that isn't going to work on the older like 3G networks anymore, use the data connection in order to make those phone calls. So just like voice over IP, now it's voice over LTE, or long-term evolution is what that stands for as well. So that being said, I have not utilized that functionality, and I believe that is going to be unique to your carrier. I have not seen, because that back end functionality happens, right, where you're doing that forwarding of the call, instead of it coming to your phone and then doing something there inside the smarts of your phone, that when you put in that call forwarding information, it's going to tell something, the system in the back end, hey, rather than forward it to this device on the phone network, you should forward it to whatever the phone number is that they've provided. And so I think probably the best bet is going to be to go to your carrier and say, this isn't working for me. Is it based upon the age of my hardware? Because the S5 is aging out for sure. Or is it something that I'm just not doing? And it might be that you can't do it on your phone, but you might be able to log into your account online and make those changes or updates to a call forwarding number. But again, I would have to default to customer service for your carrier.
Okay. Well, I was going that route myself, so we're gonna leave it at that. Ivor in Brookings has a question. He says it might be worth discussing technology in the election process. The Democratic Party had issues with its app in the Iowa caucus. I know, John, you had that as down as one of the topics you wanted to talk about. Let's just kind of go around the table and give our thoughts. So the setup of the story is, do we know what happened? Do we know what the failure was? It was in code, right?
It seemed to be just almost user error in, well, the app, yeah, some struggles with to get the app downloaded and used. I think, I don't know if they did it, deployed it through test flight, like it wasn't in the app store. I just couldn't help but laugh at the irony of hiring a company called Shadow to make this app. I mean, it seems like something would be written by Saturday Night Live. And, you know, then the inevitable, you know, it was a win for paper, I felt like, on Monday night. You know, maybe we don't need to go paperless yet. Like, the idea of just writing down and counting turns out to be maybe more useful in the democratic process. But yeah, so I think the actual, I don't remember, Amos, did you get the what happened tech-wise? I haven't heard, because I was just more following when are we going to get the results, and now I saw yesterday that the DNC chair said he suggests that they should go back and canvass the results again.
You know, I don't know what the technical glitch was. I don't know that it's even been reported, unless Jeff's heard of something, but it certainly doesn't bode well for using technology for moving forward, right?
Well, there were actually several that have been reported, and it's kind of a mix of stuff. One of the first kind of failings is a new app that wasn't put on the store. So when everyone was expected to put this on their personal smartphones, well, everyone's smartphone is different and stuff like that. So what was happening to a lot of places where it was warning you, you can't do this because this is a security risk, so they weren't even installing it.
What was the distribution mechanism?
There was some coding errors that when the results came up, it wasn't kind of doing the math kind of right on the back end in a couple of places. But, you know, that's the results are still there. That's easy to fix and stuff. But it took them, you know, a tremendous amount of time. It just seems they failed in a lot in the testing side and stuff, not realizing you have 1,000 different variations out there you have to cover, and training, and there was really no training for these people.
One
thing I will mention is, because it was a caucus, it was run by the party and not the state government like primaries are, where for primaries you go in and the state government actually and the county government actually running it. In the case of caucuses, it's the parties themselves, and it's not a governmental entity running the election, so to speak. So
yeah, I think my understanding was, you know, like when you, at least on iOS, if you have an iPhone, if you go to the App Store to download an app, but often tech companies will give you through an app called Test Flight, like they'll deploy a test environment of the app, but it's not in the App Store yet. But even that is a little bit cumbersome if you're not familiar with how to do that. And I think what Jeff's right, they didn't give a lot of methodology on how to do it, not a good forewarning.
And because it was all personal, right? You had a mix of everything. So on the Android side, they were trying to sideload it, which means you have to go into settings and disable security. And then you get prompts from the phone to these files cause security risk. This is a bad idea. So people were, you know, okay, this is a bad idea. I'm not going to install it kind of stuff.
And they were expecting the average Iowan to do that? I mean, not against the average human being.
The way you said it sounded like it was an Iowa statement. But
that's not what
I meant. And also just, I think the average political volunteer is not, does skew older, too. So it's just not, you know,
and
I think.
This was the first time it was ever deployed. It was developed in, like, I believe 4 months. And they were still developed right up to the week of the election. So I don't think it got really good stress testing either.
And I'm reading on thehill.com that apparently DHS or Department of Homeland Security offered to test the application for them, both as a stress test and for security purposes, and they declined for some reason. So
yeah, in a political environment where people... Go ahead, Jeff.
...scheduled to use this too, they are no longer using this app, so...
Yeah, I was just saying, in a political environment where I think some people already question the merit of caucuses and already wonder, hey, why does Iowa get to go first? You know, we can talk about that in a whole nother show, why that is, but I don't think the chances of an Iowa caucus happening in the same way bode very well for the future.
Well, and what's worse is than that is that now when people want to make some change, as we even saw in the South Dakota legislature this week, debate goes on about using electronic means to register for voting. Now this is in the back of everyone's head. You know, technology doesn't work well all the time. Technology does this. Technology does it. So it's just another It's another roadblock for some people, because this didn't work. So why should we try the new thing? And you know, there's people on both sides of that argument. There's some folks that would like to get rid of voting and do it all online, you know, if it can properly be done. But things like this happen, and it just makes it more difficult to get to further the advance down the road for things like that.
Right, because technology should provide more access to voting, which ultimately, in my opinion, should be the goal. But then something like this happens, which has pretty clear remedies. Like, we know how they could have fixed it, right? They could have tested it. They could have done some more training. They could have deployed it earlier. And they just didn't. And so now, things like this just become more roadblocks for people embracing
it. It breeds that mistrust in technology.
Yep, 100%.
And that's what's upsetting about it, as well as all the rest of it. You know, there's a lot of people, and is it what's the terminology, the fainting couch? When you know, everybody, they clutch their pearls and fall over and faint, and then you get these memes that come out of it. But
And then you had, Monday night was fascinating from a political standpoint of all these candidates coming out and giving their own version of more or less a winning speech, you know, claiming mm-hmm. that they won for mm-hmm. whatever reason, because really the results were up to interpretation. And so that's something that I would imagine will be written about and, you know, talked about in political science classes across the country. I mean, I think that was fascinating. And now we're on to New Hampshire, and we'll see what happens next.
And the large vacuum that happened after everybody left, you know, it's like, well, we got to get on to New Hampshire. So there they go. There's no waiting around for the tally. But very interesting how that all played out, and based on little old technology. Or little old technology that didn't work. That unfortunately is all the time we have for today's show. Thank you so much to my panelists. John T. Meyer from Lemonly, thank you so much. Amos from Exigent, keep on working those solutions, Amos. And Jeff Litterick from BIT and Peer. For everyone, thank you and have a great day. You can find us at SDPB anywhere, anytime, sdpb.org. You go there, click on Listen. And also through the SDPB app as well. Have a great weekend, everyone.